In tonight's episode of the Our Food series, which was recorded earlier this year, one of the contributors is the late Seamus Hargan, and this programme is dedicated to his memory.
Hello and welcome to Our Food with me, Mary Brophy. Coming up on today's programme, I meet a butcher.
Funny enough, kids love to see it. We have children out here all the time looking to see how the sausages are made, and they love to see it, and they're there with their mouths open and they're... And it sells more sausages as well.
A baker.
We'll make long loaves, we'll get flat loaves, we'll get pan loaves, we'll get round loaves.
And a butter maker.
Well, butter has to start first with milk. A lot depends on the grass or the grazing that the cow would be on as to what the taste of the milk will be.
First though, I'm at the Slow Food Micro Bakery here in Portlock House near Newton Cunningham, where Kamal Scarpello is firing up his brick oven. A former chef, Kamal wants to turn people on to the importance of pure, freshly baked breads. And like a true craftsman, he takes great care with his product. Hand forming each loaf, he produces only about 100 loaves a day and sells to order at local markets or restaurants. With demand currently outstripping supply, I'm here to find out just why this daily bread is so popular.
Yeah, this is our sourdough, which has been... It's been rising the whole day, but it was made. The actual yeast itself was fed 2 days ago, so that we can put three loaves on there, flung into the oven, straight onto the floor of the oven, onto the stone, the hot stone of the oven, which actually this is what wood-fired oven's all about. It's about cooking it in that method, which gives it a superior crust and a different crust formation, different flavour. Mm. It's the most healthy form of bread you can find, because it's because of not only because of the ingredients we actually use, which is a separate issue, but also because the sourdough acts in a very, it's a very weak yeast, so it doesn't rise things quickly, rise them slowly, and in that time the proteins in the flour are broken down into sort of constituent parts that we can digest properly. You smell that, you can smell.
It's almost alcoholic.
Yes, it will turn into alcohol if you give it long enough that there will be alcohol that comes off that.
Okay, explain to the uninitiated, how do you make yeast?
It's very simple. You mix flour and water. Now, the flour needs to be untreated, and the water needs to be preferably not from the tap if there's chlorine in the water. And you leave it overnight in a warm place, and you come back the next morning and you mix more flour and more water into it, and you mix it together, you cover it, and you do the same thing for the next 10 days to 2 weeks. And then eventually you'll come in one morning and it'll have doubled in size. And that's when you've created enough yeast to form a strong enough yeast to actually rise your sourdough loaf or whatever it may be. Before you know it, exponentially you'll be growing, enough. You could fill this room with it within 10 days probably.
And is that what they call a sourdough starter?
That's what you call a starter. So this is the mother dough, if you like. We use this to make other yeasts.
Each loaf is left to rise for long periods to fully develop the flavours before being fired in the oven.
This here is still warm from this morning's bake. We want to get a lot of heat into there, and that's how we bake our bread, because it's what they call a falling oven. So at the very beginning we put in breads that require more heat. And then as we go along, we need less and less heat. So it does reduce in heat. You haven't got a searing heat at the end, but you're still able to cook sort of breads that maybe, sweet breads and cakes and pastries and things that don't need as much heat. We have to fire this oven early from now until probably, 3 or 4 in the morning. And then we gradually bring it down and then take out all the coals, all the ash, clean the floor, and it's ready to bake within an hour of that.
Is this rare?
This is very rare, yes. I mean, there are... Still, as far as I know, there are only two. I know there's one down in Tipperary, Clough Jordan, and ourselves. And other than that, it is, it's pretty hard to find. So, if you believe in doing something right, it's an old method of baking bread, but it's also the best way of baking bread. It's just not very practical for big bakeries to use wood ovens because of the inflexibility of them, I suppose, and the getting that consistency that they're always looking for. They want everything to look exactly the same all the time, as craft bakers, you know, we expect not to get exactly the same result every time, and it depends on the weather, it depends on the wood that we're using, it depends on various other things.
I've only made bread a few times, and I often think I should be making a lot here, because the amount of effort you go to for one loaf always seems like too much, you know?
That's what we find, you know, particularly sourdoughs is of quite a lot of interest at the minute. It's not a difficult thing to do, very simple ingredients, very simple processes. It's just that if you haven't got the time to dedicate to it, then you're not going to...
You're not going to learn the craft, which is it is, and craft is usually about time.
It is, of course, yeah, it's about that. This is the sourdough, so this one, it's proved together in one large piece, and then we go about cutting it into smaller pieces, so individual loaves.
So you're shaping these into very much like what a soda bread would be shaped into.
So I mean, this is actually a third prove. So we shape them into rounds, first of all. And from rounds, we may get long loaves, we'll get flat loaves, we'll get pan loaves, we'll get round loaves, you know, but we'll shape each one differently. So, but this is the third prove stage. It's a very short one, but it's an important one, because it allows the dough, the protein, as it were, to relax again.
Okay.
So it's careful, you know, it's been careful at every stage. That's why, you know, hand cutting dough and making it by hand gives you the best opportunity to, you know, to see each process through. So we make our starter on, say, any given morning. That rises overnight. The following morning, we use that starter to make a bread. So we add that to more flour and blend of flours usually. Which may be wholemeal, rye, white, spelt, depends on what we're using. And then we add salt, sea salt, and we add water, and that's it. So that's all we put into our stone ground sourdough, which is our best seller. That's the one you can see. But it's a process that takes, you know, 3 days from start to finish.
That's a very special loaf when you think about it, that if it's done, like, it's taking all that amount of time, and the craft is going into it at every stage.
Yeah, well, we think so, certainly. I mean, it's, and to be fair, you know, the response from people do realise that, you know, they do. Some people are incredibly passionate about it, and, you know, and other people don't understand it, of course, but we always knew that. I'm grateful that so many people around here actually understand what we're trying to do. You know, they do appreciate it. Certainly, there's a lot of positive feedback we get, you know.
So the lovely crispy crust you can see.
Yeah, and we've got a nice texture inside. You can see it's relatively even, which is good. I don't have to have it even. Again, I don't, you know, I'm not pedantic about everything looking the way it should, but that's not really what we're about. But that's certainly a good result.
It's like an arrow. There's lovely bubbles of air right through it.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm going to give you...
I can taste the yeast. I can taste what I smelt earlier. It's delicious. Absolutely delicious.
There is a sharpness to it. You can taste, you know, it is sour at the end of the day, but, you know, there are ways of balancing that. So that's why I say I think it's a middle of the road. It's not overly sour.
How has the response been?
Response has been incredible. It really has. It's been surprising at times, you know, how good. Certainly, you know, like-minded people come looking for this sort of product. If it's, you know, it mightn't be bread, it might be fresh other ingredients, good, you know, well made anything, locally made anything, but those people are definitely around. You know, it's not a mass market, but it's there and it's growing. So, you know, I've been incredibly happy with the way things have gone so far. I couldn't be happier, you know, really.
Now, while the battle has raged for years between butter and margarine, recent research published in the British Medical Journal argues that butter is not as bad for the heart as has been maintained. That's good news for those of us who like nothing better than buttered toast or to use it for cooking. But have you ever tried making your own? In Seamus Harkin's kitchen, I discover the simple pleasures of one of our most iconic rural traditions, butter making.
Well, I'd have to tell about the gathering of the milk, first of all. You're operating. Okay, Mary. You want to know about butter making? Well, butter has to start first with milk. And as you know, the milk comes from the cow. So a lot depends on the grass or the grazing that the cow would be on as to what the taste of the milk will be. Now, if the cow is grazing on clover and strong grass, the milk will have a very strong flavour. So that was why it was very important years ago for farmers to have an outlet to a hill area where there was heather. The cows would spend part of the day, half of the day on the grass, and then they were sent to the hill. And they got heather plus water, which were usually on the hills. And that made a nice blend, a nice taste for the butter. The butter was better. So that done, and a reasonably good flavour on the milk. And the milk was skimmed, cream skimmed off the top of it. They went a good lot of milk with it. And that was important because that made the buttermilk. If you have only cream only, you'll have no buttermilk. You'll just have butter, nothing left. It was put into the churn. The churn was taken then up towards the fire if it was the winter time. It was the summertime, be kept back. But it had to be at least room temperature, nice and warm. And if there was sun shining in the door and the window, it was an advantage because they would leave the churn sitting in the middle of the sunshine. The dash, then, this was a shaft up and down with an agitator in the bottom of it. And it just kept going up and down and up and down. There was a lot of old superstitions in those days. And if somebody come in, they would need to say, God bless the work. Because if they didn't, it would be looked on by the old people anyway. The old woman sitting at the fire would think that they put some kind of a curse on the churning. And the butter might never come on it, you know. That might happen hours today. Somebody might put a curse on it passing or something. So now, we could maybe progress.
Tell me what we have here in front
now,
of us.
Well, what we have here today now is a bowl and cream in it that I bought in the shop. I'll be truthful about it. This didn't come. It came from a cow somewhere. It's Donegal cream, the best of stuff. And what I'll use as the churn is a food mixer. So we have the pats here. Two wooden things for patting the butter together. Longest things with little ridges in them. I don't have the skill the old women had. They could throw the lump of butter from one to the other. I wouldn't trust myself to that. I could end up with the butter on the floor. But
so in front of us, we have your food mixer.
Food mixer.
We have, here's the bowl of cream.
The bowl of cream.
And it's been sitting out to go to room temperature.
It was sitting out to go to room temperature, and we'll try it. So what do you think, Mary? Will we start the churning?
I think we'll have a go.
And right, what do you like of this? You see now it's starting to. It's moved up on now to the butter stage.
So it's kind of separating.
Separating, yeah.
Yeah.
Aye. See what's left, I was saying, there's only a watery stuff.
So you've lumps a bit like cottage cheese
at
this stage.
Aye. The next job on this is the washing. The whole thing in good butter was washing. If the butter wasn't properly washed, it would smell. No woman wanted the name of having butter that smelt. And get the water good and cold. Now, this butter that I'm making wouldn't taste anything like the real butter from a cow. The summertime butter, like, was different to the wintertime butter. There was a better flavour, there was stronger flavour because of all the fresh grass. So it's the same with anything in nature. Anything is made from the natural stuff. There were so many things cows were eating. They ate apples. Apples put a rare flavour on the butter. It's more like cider. So what would we go on to the salting?
That's next.
Now, I'll get the salt here. Now,
and you're just using table salt?
Table salt, yeah. The washing has to continue with...
After the salt has gone in?
After the salt. Because you wash the salt in through it and take some of it out again, you know. It's amazing how butter can absorb salt. it absorbs a lot of salt. You roll it around until you get it into a ball. If you had anyone, especially someone important, coming for tea in the evening, it was nice to have the little roll, the little balls. It was a wee bit more upmarket.
Very posh.
Yes, yeah. Posh. It's very posh. Especially if the Yankees come in, you know.
And it's easy to make, really.
Oh, it
is,
aye. Now, don't think there'll be much profit in it, you know. Sure, we could make a cup of tea now, and we'll have some of it in the scones there. And
you need to get the track of your teeth in it.
It tastes good to me.
Aye, it's butter, all right.
Come with me.
I'm in McGettigan's Butchers in Donegal Town, where Ernan McGettigan is about to mix up one of his award-winning batches.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see.
We're in the fridge now. The process starts here. What we do is we mince the pork, this drum. And then the other meats, if we have beef, we mince them separately, lamb separately, chicken separately. But this is a hickory sausage that we're making now, so we have to weigh it out. There's about 500 or 600 pounds of pork in there. We weigh it out here. So we need 9.1 kilos here now. I'm not giving away any of my secrets.
We haven't got to the ingredients yet.
No.
And this is like a massive
It's like a big food processor.
Yeah.
It's exactly what it's like. So we just have to get the seasoning and the other ingredients already made. So
it's lovely, pale, like a white pepper.
Well, there's absolutely no colouring in the seasoning, so it's just natural. That's our dried breadcrumbs, but the first thing we have to do is get the marinade that we use. Every butcher has their own mix. Now, there's lots of butchers would love to know what's in that mix, but they know the basics of it. It's a hickory and maple. But there's lots of other ingredients put in there to make it defined to us. You know, it's actually a sauce based. I would still call it a marinade because it gets into the meat and it flavours it. You know, So we turn on the bowl chopper now, and you can at the slow speed. Remember, add the breadcrumbs.
You're as much binding it as you are coarsely
exactly
chopping it.
You see, the problem is if you over-chop, you over-bind, and it comes out as a rubbery-type sausage meat. Our meat contents are anything from 70 to 80% meat, so we keep the quantity of meat high, but you also have to have a balance of fat and lean. It's the balance between meat, rusks, and the binders and the seasonings. Too much meat, it tastes more like a meatloaf than it would a sausage, and the consistency gives it the appearance of being very tough.
Yeah.
You know? We use bellies of pork and shoulder pork, and we mix the two together. Two-thirds belly, one-third shoulder. And the shoulder, lean shoulder, pulls up the fat content. Now, we use lean bellies as well. So you have the belly has a lovely flavour. A lot of manufactured sausages never see belly of pork at all because it's too expensive. If you want quality, you go for the belly. And then you use the shoulder then to bring the lean content up to a certain level until you have the right consistency. And that's unique. So we move away from the filler now, and we'll link a few just to give you an idea of what linking's all about.
There's a famous line in the West Wing TV series that there's two things you should never see, laws being made, laws or sausages.
No. You can come into any craft butcher shop and watch the process. The public are watching us. You can see us clear glass all the way out, so they see exactly what we're at. Funny enough, kids love to see it. We have children out here all the time looking to see how the sausages are made, and they love to see it, and they're there with their mouths open in there, and it sells more sausages as well.
You're doing all of this yourself. I mean, you still do this. You haven't farmed that out to somebody else or some
training. No, I have another young lad that helps me now, and I'm training him now on the linking of it. My brother Dermot over there does it as well, so there's always backup in case I'm not here, you know. But I think this is what traditional butchers is all about. We don't sit in an office. We do the job. The key to our business is that since 1952 we've been slaughtering our animals on this premises. We have full traceability.
I mean, it's all about traceability and the confidence that the customer has with your product and knows that you know where it came from and you can tell them exactly where it came from. And it's the same thing with the farmers. They know exactly what type of an animal we require. They won't come with anything else. And it's all about building up that relationship, and nobody can do that better than a craft butcher.
At the end of the day, this trolley is absolutely jammed with different types of sausages. These are ones I made earlier. That's a pork and apple. You see, you make them at different times because you have different flavours. The first one I would have made is this gluten-free pork sausage here. Then we have our Slimmers one, as I explained to you. That was made earlier, and a beef sausage here. And this is one of our favourite ones. It's pork chilli chocolate and orange sausage.
In the world of my creation,
what will Belgian see? Chocolate, which is over 72% cocoa content, and an orange chutney. The Belgian chocolate's bitter. The chutney's sweeter. And then you have the kick of the chilli. And that's a novelty sausage, but it's good as well. It tastes good, you know.
And where do you get your inspiration for the recipe?
In my head, most of the time, you know.
There's the Willy Wonka going on there of sausages.
Yeah, well,
is there?
Funny enough, that's what Nevin Maguire calls me as well, the Willy Wonka of sausages, you know.
And who gets to taste all of the inventions?
See these guinea pigs here, Sean here, my brother Dermot, the girls in the office, whoever happens to be around, and of course the most important person, our customers.
I come in because I love their food. I've been coming for, I'm sure, almost 50 years. You know, you can see what you're getting, you know, and see them cutting it and that.
That's beef kidney there.
Yeah, that's lovely, Sean, thank you.
There's a lot of misrepresentation, a lot of misinformation about butcher shops being more expensive. There's value for money to be found in every butcher shop in Ireland with quality behind it. That's the difference. You're still going to get that value. If you go into a package situation, 9 times out of 10, if you look at that and you think you're getting value, if you convert everything back and look at the weights that you're actually getting, the value for money goes out the window straight away. I can guarantee it. There are loss leaders, without a doubt, but the vast majority of meats, if you buy from your local craft butcher, you will save money. This is the slaughterhouse down here.
So literally at your back door you have the slaughterhouse.
Yeah. Everything's like a conveyor in here.
Yeah.
They walk in the back gate and they go out in a bag out the front door. I mean, in here...
This is a massive...
Well, it's a 12-foot door to take the full side of beef, you know, so wheel them in there, hanging there. These are lambs.
The long one.
Yeah, that's your four-quarter. Then your sirloin's a bit in the middle. And then you have your hind quarter at the top. And we hang that was killed last Monday. Now we would hang them longer than that sometimes.
But this room is really cold.
This is between one and 5 degrees, and 5 degrees. This is an actual fridge.
So you leave them out here?
Yeah, overnight.
To let it overnight cool down,
and then bring them into the fridge the next day.
Yeah.
The biggest problem is if you're slaughtering in one place and you're bringing the meat to another place, as long as the distance isn't great, I don't see any problem in it. But when the distance is great, you have added problems straight away. And it works here. It doesn't work in all places. It probably wouldn't work in city-type situations. But in small rural situations, small rural towns, I think it should be allowed.
It's quite strange because, as you said, we're at the back door of Aldi here in Donegal Town and a couple of hundred yards from the main street. And there's quite an agricultural pen here. Yeah. Literally, the animals come
in. That's the key. You can keep good housekeeping in order and operate a system like this right in the heart of a built-up area without any fuss to anybody. I still feel that butchers, in particular speciality people like us, should be allowed to have their crafts in place where they want it and to exist, because it's, after all, it's traditional. If you take tradition out of it, what have you got left? We want to know that the animals that we inspect in a field and look at in a field, we take them in here, we slaughter them and we give them to the public, and we want to have the confidence that we know where the animal came from, that the people we're chatting to over that counter up there know that we know where the cattle came from, and that we pass that information on to them.
Can I have... What other nice herby ones have you got?
Hickory maple are very nice. Oh, can I have a smoky
hickory
barbecue
Go
flavor?
Ahead, give me six of them.
Six of
those. Thank you.
There you go now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy that.
Well, that's it for this week. Tune in next time for more of our food stories from around the county.
Our Food is a Hollybrook production for Highland Radio, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.